The Cuban American Experience told through the eyes of a playwright. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Playwright Nilo Cruz arrived in Florida in 1970 on the Freedom Flights. His experiences in Cuba and growing up in the U.S. have shaped his work ever since. In 2003, he became the first Latino to win the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. He'll join us for a discussion about attracting new audiences to the theater and his upcoming weekend at Florida Atlantic University. Holly Neher is the first ever female to start as a quarterback for a high school football team here in the state of Florida. She'll tell us about her fight to be given a chance to play with the boys. And WLRN's Wilson Sayre will join us for a conversation about tonight's planned execution in Florida. All of that and more coming up today on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Michael Lambrex is set to be executed in Stark, Florida today. His execution is set for 6 p.m. He is the second person in Florida to be executed this year. Now, the state only recently resumed executions after the U.S. Supreme Court declared that Florida's sentencing process was unconstitutional. WLRN's Wilson Sayre is in Stark, Florida, where she spoke with Lambrex before his set execution today, and she joins us now. Wilson, always a pleasure.
Hey, Lewis.
Real quickly, at this point, I was curious, can an execution be stopped, or is Michael Lambrex going to be executed tonight no matter what?
It can be stopped. It would have to be stopped by the U.S. Supreme Court, or in some unusual turn of events, the state Supreme Court. That is very unlikely, given that the previous execution of Mark Acey at the end of August went forward. So it is likely that this will happen tonight.
Who is Michael Lambrex?
He is a 57-year-old guy. He's been on death row for 34 years. He was convicted in 1984 of murdering two people, one by strangulation and the other by hitting them over the head with a tire iron. He has, since the beginning, maintained his innocence, though he's been more vocal about that in the sort of second half of his time on death row. He has been very vocal, unusually vocal for being on death row, which is how I got to him. But he is sort of preparing right now for his execution.
You've talked to him more than once, right?
Yeah. We corresponded. We sent more than a dozen letters back and forth over a year and a half. I've interviewed him now three times, and I've talked with his family and some of his friends. His son called me on Tuesday, and we talked very briefly about their preparations. I've gotten to know him pretty well.
Has anything changed in his tone or his comments, from the first conversation you had with him compared to the last time you talked to him?
Well, the last time I talked to him before this week, he was under a stay of execution. The courts were still litigating an issue about whether or not people on death row would get relief because a U.S. Supreme Court decision and a state Supreme Court decision sort of in a 1-2 punch threw out the state's method for sentencing people to death. It ruled it unconstitutional. For one reason, people who were sentenced to death could be sentenced to death without a unanimous jury. So there's sort of two steps in a jury. One is whether or not they did the crime, whether they're convicted of the crime. The second is whether or not they go to the death penalty. And Florida for many, many, many years was unusual in that it didn't require a unanimous jury to send somebody to death. So Lambrex is one of those people, and there was a big question about whether or not he would get a chance, like now more than 100 have in the state, to get a new sentence. But because his case is so old, he is barred from that, given the way that the state Supreme Court has written its opinion. He thinks that it's going to happen this time, whereas previous times he thought he it was a pretty good case. He still thinks he has a good case. He is more concerned about his innocence claims, which are a challenging thing to bring at this point in the appeals process. Generally, if you think, you know, that your lawyers didn't do a good job or there wasn't evidence in truth in your trial, you have a pretty narrow window of when to bring that stuff up. He says, you know, his lawyers didn't bring everything up. And so he's more concerned about that, where his lawyers who have been submitting appeals are sort of focusing more on the most recent change to the death penalty law.
And you talked about the U.S. Supreme Court decision and how there are now quite a few people on death row arguing their case, saying that, well, see, now we have to give that get a resentencing. How many people are making that argument now? What are their chances?
Yeah, so it's any case after 2002, the summer of 2002, which is when a separate U.S. Supreme Court came out that this one is based off of. So that's sort of the line in the sand. So for cases that have been finalized after that date and that were not unanimous in the jury decision to send them to the death penalty, those have pretty routinely been granted new sentences. So this doesn't mean that they won't be executed or they won't get another death penalty. It just means they have to go through that process again of getting a new sentence. Now, that is going to take a very long time because some of these cases, you know, date back years. And so prosecutors are having to reassemble all of these cases. And the term finalized is very important because some of these people, the crimes happened in the 80s, 70s, but they were retried for a number of reasons, and so their case was finalized after. So these are cases from 1970s, 1980s that prosecutors are having to put back together to then show to a jury to then seek the death penalty or not. So this is going to be a very long process, but people who did not have a unanimous jury post-2002 have pretty consistently been granted at least that opportunity.
As you said, Michael Lambrechts has been very vocal about his story, his innocence, but also his story and life behind bars. We do have, by the way, a reminder that there is a special at WLRN.org that you produced called Cell One. And of course, we'll have a link up so people can go back and listen to that. But just some of the comments that he's made recently about his story, he's gathered about, you know, why he wants to share this story with everybody.
The death penalty is a commentary on who we are as a society. And that's why it's important that those of us on this side of the bars, on my side of the bars, try to help others to understand this side of it.
He also went on a hunger strike recently. This was when he was given a new date for an execution, I should say, and this is what he had to say about that.
I fully intended to begin the hunger strike when they rescheduled my execution and maintain it until the day of execution. However, what I did not anticipate is how much it would affect my family. I have been blessed with a most incredible family and friends around the world who put so much of themselves and sacrificed so much of themselves to help me. And so when I realized how much it was affecting them, after 12 days, I voluntarily terminated the hunger strike.
You know, Wilson, I wondered in all the times that you spoke with Michael Lambrechts, what was the most shocking thing that he told you?
Well, you know, he's written so extensively that nothing was particularly shocking. But one of the things about his case that I think we all should understand and use that to look at the death penalty is that he was offered a plea deal a couple of times, which would have allowed him to walk free more than a decade ago had he accepted it. So I think, you know, while that's not unique, it is interesting that even when he had the opportunity to take a lesser sentence, you know, he didn't know at that time that he would indeed be convicted and then sent to death row. He maintained his innocence even during that, and really, had he accepted that, he would have been out. And so I think he's not surprised that he's here, but he said he regrets sort of being less vocal at the beginning. He says he regrets not giving a full statement and telling everything to the police at the time. You know, he had had a couple of minor run-ins with the law, and was under the impression the best way to handle that was to be quiet. And he says, you know, I looking back, that's not the way that he would have acted.
I think about, again, your piece, produced piece for WLRN Cell 1. And one of the things I found fascinating, I wanted to ask you, because as you mentioned a moment ago, that it seems that Mr. Lambrix has basically accepted this, that this is going to happen today, and perhaps he's preparing himself for it. But something that I remember from your piece was that mindset of a person once they reach that final cell before their execution. And I wondered if you'd seen anything in him that kind of indicates that to you, that he's now accepted this fate. And unless something does happen in about 5 hours, less than 5 hours, he's going to be executed.
Well, I mean, it's a very slow process that takes a person from death row, and then when their death warrant is signed, to death watch, which is cell one, which is the last cell that you stay in before you're escorted to the death chamber. And then there's sort of various phases where you are allowed to have stuff in your room, and then they take that out, and sort of the frequency of meetings with your family members change. So it's a long sort of reckoning, I think, for him, for his family. You know, they are desperately trying to get a letter to the governor asking him to hold a clemency hearing, reaching out to the media. So, you know, while I think sort of people on the outside have the ability to do these last-minute appeals and big pushes, you know, he has establish what his last meal will be, which he probably would have eaten by now, which was going to be a Thanksgiving dinner, a turkey dinner. That was his pact with his mom, is when he got out, that's what they would do. They'd have a big Thanksgiving dinner together. And so since he won't be able to get out at this point, or unlikely that he will, he will have that meal. He can't share it with them. He'll eat behind a glass panel, but it will be during visitation time, so his family will be there. You know, he tried on his death suit, is what he called it, and they had to sort of make adjustments because he lost a lot of weight during his hunger strike. He's called friends, he's written sort of last letters to people. So it's been a long process for him, and this is the fourth date that he has had for his execution. So this isn't the first time he's had to prepare. But I think given the trajectory of the courts and the fact that nobody who has had their death warrant signed by Governor Rick Scott has gotten out of it, I think, you know, he recognizes this is the last time he'll go through those processes.
WLRN's Wilson Sarah is in Stark, Florida, for tonight's execution of Michael Lambrix. Her series, again, called Cell 1, is online. It's at WLRN.org. Please check it out. Wilson, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to change things up a little bit as we go to break here. We're going to come back and have a sit-down with Pulitzer Prize playwright Nilo Cruz. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, we live in a time when our attention is being pulled in all sorts of directions. You know, I'm wondering, where in a world where we have so many options on the big screen and now in the small ones, does theater fit into that? Well, here's the thing. The good news is that if you're a theater lover, on average, about 47 million Americans attend a live theater event every month. So theater's alive and well. We're talking about theater because our next guest is the winner of the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for his play Anna in the Tropics, a drama set in Ybor City in 1929, which tells the story of a Cuban-American family of cigar makers. He splits his time between Miami and New York. This weekend, he's at Florida Atlantic University as part of its Playwrights Forum and Masterclass series. I am honored to be sitting here with Nilo Cruz on Sundial. Nilo Cruz, welcome, man.
Thank you very much.
It is a pleasure. You know what? I was thinking about that, you know, with theater attendance seems to be pretty high, especially in Broadway, but I've read that you feel there's a problem with theater and that it's about opening theater up to more diverse writers, but also more diverse audiences. And so I just want your thoughts on how exactly do we do that?
Well, I think that we need to write about the other. We just cannot just concentrate on events that are happening in our country. I think it's important to embrace the world, different subject matters, and so that way you get an array of people coming to the theater. And I think once they see a play that they identify with, then they probably will come back to the theater and see a play that perhaps has nothing to do with them or their identity. But they would be somehow inspired to come back to the theater and be part of it.
I'd imagine that's, you got to get what, through the producers, right? I mean, the people who are running the theaters, to convince them to be a little more daring and find those plays. They're playwrights all over the world. Find those plays and present those to audiences. But really, how do you get past that? How do you convince them, those gatekeepers, I guess, to open it up?
Well, I mean, that's a beautiful thing about Theater Lab. Theater Lab has been concentrating on doing new work. Before it was Theater Lab, it used to be Florida Stage in Palm Beach. And it was actually Florida Stage was the first theater company to do my work here in Florida, in South Florida. And but I think that there's a lot of theaters out there that are really embracing new work. And I have a theater company, Coarca Images, and we embrace new work, and we do theater in English and Spanish. So there's a lot of us out there who are really trying to, again, inspire a new audience and bring to the theater a new audience.
And if, from your experience in all these years and the decades, really, you know, are the audiences open to those experiences, or do you have to kind of pull them in a little bit?
They are open. You'd be surprised. And I tell you, I mean, I spend more time here in Florida than I do in New York because I feel I can make a difference here in Miami with the theater community. And again, that's what I'm trying to do is try to, it might be pretentious on my part, but to try to revolutionize the theater and really get people back to the seats and where they can experience profound theater, and in theater that has to do with politics and, but just playwrights who really are daring in the way they observe humanity and bring it to the stage.
You're the first Latino to win the Pulitzer in drama, correct?
Yes, I am.
Lin-Manuel Miranda has also won one as well. I'm curious, you know, I mean, look, when you win that award, I mean, now it's with your name, and that brings something. I don't want to say credibility because, you know, you can have a lot of credibility without it, but obviously it puts you more in the spotlight. People see that. I wonder, though, this, when I bring up Mr. Miranda because of the success of Hamilton. Mm-hmm. What has that done to, again, attract more audiences? Because with Hamilton, he's got a show that is approaching a topic in a very unique way. He's brought hip-hop to theater, but he's also using Black and Hispanic actors playing roles of the white founders of the country. How has that helped theater, or has it? Maybe it's just in Broadway.
Oh, I think it has really helped theater tremendously because of the use of music, of hip-hop music. It really, inspires the young generation to come to the theater. But what's really great about it is that it isn't just the appeal of hip-hop music, but with it comes this subject matter, which is really deep, which is about American history. So it's very smart what he's done. And I think that a lot of new theater, the new theater audience that he's creating will probably come back to the theater. And you just need one play to inspire you.
One show opens
absolutely
it up.
Absolutely. And I think this is what Hamilton will do. It's creating a whole new generation of audience members.
Again, I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Nilo Cruz. Again, this weekend, he's at Florida Atlantic University as part of its Playwrights Forum and Masterclass series. I wanted to talk to you about the themes of your plays. They tend to be centered on the immigrant experience. And of course, you know, as I mentioned, you're a Cuban American. And you arrived in Florida, was it 1970s?
1970, yes.
1970, exactly. And it was part of the Freedom Flights.
Yes.
What are your memories of the era, that era in your life, and leaving Cuba and arriving in the United States?
Well, when I came to the States, I felt very secluded. It was a foreign country to my parents. It was certainly a foreign country to me. And so I lived a very secluded life, which is not a bad thing, because that's now I'm not afraid of being secluded or the loneliness that I have to confront when I face the empty page. And because, you know, the life of a writer is all about solitude and being able to observe the world from a certain distance.
I mean, how old were you at that point when you got here?
I was 10 years old.
That's already this really important part of our lives as we're transitioning and growing up. So you're already going through this very big experience and leaving one country, coming to another. Was that transition easy for you at all? What was it like when you got here?
No. Well, imagine, I felt like I had to grow very, very fast. My parents didn't speak the language. I didn't speak the language either. As a matter of fact, when I started to learn the language, I became the translator for my parents. So here's a little boy that was 10 years old that was translating for their parents. Every time they would get a bill at home, I was the one who had to read the bill, and which came in very handy too, because there were times that I didn't show my report card to my parents.
I tried not to either, but I didn't have luck with that. So when did you start writing? Do you remember the first thing you wrote?
Yes, I started writing when I was 28 years old. But before that, I was taking theater classes. Matter of fact, I started taking theater classes here in Miami at Miami-Dade College, when I really became serious about it was when I went to New York and I studied with Cuban fellow writer Maria Irene Fornes, and who became my mentor. Studied with her for 3 years in New York.
I want to come back, though, when you started theater, and how did that happen? What was that first moment where all of a sudden you're like, well, I got to go try this?
I was working at Cedars of Lebanon, which is the UM hospital in the physical therapy department. And one day I had this epiphany to go to the theater, and I went to Coconut Grove Playhouse and saw a play called The Dresser. And I was mesmerized by that play. And I thought to myself, I want to be part of the theater. I don't know in what capacity, whether I want to be an actor or a director or a scenic designer, but I want to be part of the theater. And that's when this next day, I decided to enroll at Miami-Dade College and study with Teresa Maria Rojas, who had a theater company called Prometeo.
Did you have any pressure from your parents, though? I mean, when you told them what you wanted to do, or was it, you know, great, go for it, son, do it?
I think they were happy that I found that maybe I found the road to something. I mean, of course, they wanted for me to maybe study something a bit different, perhaps be a doctor, but they couldn't stop me. It's a passion. It was a fever that I couldn't make it go away, and they couldn't make it. They couldn't stop it for me. And from then on, my life changed. That it just I surrendered to the art form of theater, and that led me to New York, led me to graduate school, and led me to great theaters like the Public Theater in New York, where I became an artist in residence.
Right from the beginning, when you started writing, when you really started taking it seriously, was it just easy for you to always go back to what you know? Not all writers do. I know they tell you, write what you know. But was it easy for you to just go back? Because so many of the themes of yours, you know, again, that immigrant experience, did you just go back to that? Or did you fall into this by accident somehow?
I always go back to usually Cuba. I go back to Cuba in many ways, and my experience and the struggles that I saw my parents go through. But I think every time I enter a play is that I forget that I'm a writer. I feel like I have to learn the rules of the new play, that I don't impose the rules on the play. I have to learn the new rules of the play, and I have to do research, and I have to... It's almost like embarking on a journey and in unknown territory, and I have to document myself, and I have to let the writing take its own course.
Was A Park in Our House, was that your first play? It's one of your first plays.
No, to be honest with you, my first play had to do with Italian Americans. I was in New York and sort of very inspired by the Italian American community. in New York, and I thought that I could write about Italians, about Cubans via Italians, you know, and that the immigrant experience, which of course was very different, but somehow I was a little terrified about writing about the Cuban experience in Miami, and I did it in a very indirect way. And much later, a producer came to me and said, "Well, what are you doing writing about Italians? You should write about your own people." And I did. It was at that play, which became, it was called Boot Country at one point, and it later became a Bicycle Country, which is about balseros coming from Cuba to the United States.
Why were you afraid of writing about being a Cuban?
I tell you, I was here in Miami when there was a bomb threat during the Hispanic Theater Festival for a writer who lived in New York, who was Cuban, and she was considered a leftist writer. So I sort of became a little terrified, you know, with that experience. And also I just felt that being here in Miami is that it seemed like with the Cuban community in Miami is that their pain was so grand that it felt like if you would write about anything related to Cuba, you were not able to encompass that great pain. So it took me a while to, but I mean, I think more than anything is that a writer needs to come to, a writer needs to find his or her voice. And it takes a while before you find your voice. I had a student from Iraq who was not able to write about her experience, really wanted to write about what was happening in her country, but couldn't do it. And I said, you know what, just imagine another character and place your own experiences into that character that is not you, and allow the writing to change. So I think that's something that happened to me with that initial experience of writing about Italians, but somehow really writing about Cubans. And then, of course, then later on, I just obtained the courage to write about anything I want. As a matter of fact, in this festival, I've written about Afghanistan, a young girl in Afghanistan who disguises herself as a boy in order to survive in that country.
We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Nilo Cruz and talking about that process of finding your voice as a writer, as a playwright. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of his latest works coming up right here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I am joined in studio by the 2003 Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, Nilo Cruz. He won it for the play Anna in the Tropics. He is part of Florida Atlantic University's Playwrights Forum and Masterclass series this weekend. And we'll have information up on our website about that. You know, Nilo, we were talking before, and I mentioned one of your first plays, A Park in Our House. And I wanted to ask you about that because that's semi-autobiographical, right? It had to do with an event in Cuba in 1970, I believe it was. And this was back, I had to look this up. It was when Fidel Castro ordered the 10 million tons of sugar harvest program. Briefly describe what that is and how that was, you know, part of the story you wanted to portray.
Well, it takes place in 1970. I was 10 years old, and that was what was happening in the country at that time, that people were forced into they said that it was voluntary work, but it really wasn't voluntary work. As a matter of fact, I remember when the government, guards from the government would come to my house to tell my father to work in the field for this safra, which was called sugar cane safra in Cuba. And so here in my play, there's a character named Camilo, which is basically a mute boy who's observing all these things. And I don't think he was mute from the moment he was born. I think that through some fright that he became mute, and so he becomes the observant in the play, which of course is me in some ways. It's the essence of me, but sort of abstracted. So it's the play is about this young boy looking at what's happening all around him, and also living a dual kind of reality of, you know, seeing his mom and his mom, actually his aunt and his uncle, come in the middle of the night with a pig from the black market, but not being able to tell others that the family was getting food from the black market. And so, and I witnessed that as a young boy. And I felt it was important to write about that moment in history as a way. And the project came from the MacArthur Theater. They asked five or six writers to write about home. And when I was giving the subject matter, I wrote about Cuba instead of the United States, even though I had lived here longer than I did in Cuba. But somehow I went to Cuba, and that was how I wrote about home.
Something you said a little while ago I thought was fascinating is, sometimes writers are afraid to write about their history or the country they come from or their life because maybe there is a risk. But this comes back to what was happening in South Florida, in that early era of your life in the Cuban community. I mean, is it something that did you notice people were quiet about, life in Cuba, the history of Cuba, the history of what happened with Castro? Were they very vocal about it, or you had to be careful where you stood on what side because, well, that could be dangerous? I mean, what was happening at that time?
No, I think people were very outspoken about what was happening in Cuba. And to be honest with you, it was a little too much. And because when I would come home from school, it was my grandmother with the radio. And of course, and we were in a state of waiting. I think that especially my family came to this country with the expectation of always going back to Cuba. So it was always a state of waiting. And to me, for me, it was different. I wanted to be an American. I wanted to embrace the English language. And I just wanted to become as Americanizado as I could, Americanized as much as I could, because I don't know, it may be, I just realized that the English language was la lengua franca, and I went out of my way even to get out of ESL school. I knew that a way out of ESL class, I should say, was to ask the teacher to let me go to the bathroom in English instead of in Spanish.
And the ESL class is the English-Spanish language classes that you have to take.
Yes. And so I knew that I just wanted to be, I just wanted to fit. I wanted to be a North American boy and be part of the land of opportunity. And I made choices for myself, but even as a little boy, I knew that I had to do that.
is English, do you consider it your first language, your second language, Spanish?
I educated myself in this country, so I'm more fluent in English than I am in Spanish, even though I have my inflections tend to be Latin, than to be in Spanish. But Spanish is my first language. But the fact that this is where I went to school, and this is where I went to university, and I learned to write in English, not in Spanish, even though sometimes I write in Spanish as well.
That's a good segue. I want to talk about, the time that you spend with students. And again, you're going to be at Florida Atlantic University this weekend. When you are working with students, this comes back to this idea that being a writer could be so solitary. Granted, playwrights, it's a little different because it is solitary when you're writing it. Yes. But there's also a part of the process, if I'm not mistaken, where you get to work with actors to see how your story works on
stage.
That's
the best part of it, when you get to work with actors. And because really, that's where the theater comes to, the play comes to its full fruition. And it's when it's actually seen on a stage and where you actually start working in the actual studio, which I consider this is like the artist studio for a playwright is being on a stage or being in a rehearsal room exploring the play with actors and a director.
What's it like when you're working with students?
I learned to write with a group of writers, and when I was at INTAR in New York at a playwriting lab, we would start writing at 9 o'clock in the morning and write for like 2 or 3 hours. So what I do when I teach my classes is that I give exercises to the students and we all write together. And what's beautiful about it, and it isn't just about me teaching but it's about the students seeing or learning from other students when I give an exercise and see how other students approach the exercise and the many ways you can write about a subject matter. So that's the beauty about teaching this way. It just was just in a, with a group of writers.
And do you teach them your process, as you said earlier, about you like to research first? There was one piece, for example, I really found interesting with your work is the story of the SS St. Louis. And this goes to your show, your play, Sotto Voces.
Yeah.
And just real quickly, this is the story of a ship that had Jewish refugees who were escaping the Third Reich in World War II, but they were trying to arrive in Cuba, and Cuba said no and sent them away. And they had to end up going back to Europe. But so you had to do a lot of research for this. I mean, in your work, you know, how much of it is research? How much of it is just your inspiration in that process? And how long does it take to put a show together?
Well, sometimes it could take a year. Sometimes it could take 2 years. And with Sotto Voce, I looked at that moment in history and I researched that moment. I wrote scenes that took place at that moment in history. And then I thought that I should not set the play back in 1939, that I should set it in modern times. So it became a memory play. There was a character in the piece who had a lover who was on that ship. And that's a chapter in her life that she's tried to forget. And then in the piece, there's someone, a student who's doing research on the subject matter. So the student almost becomes me, you know, in some way. So I become the student in a way of like searching, doing research on the subject matter. And of course, then I look at one of the things that I was very intrigued by Sotto Voce was that this concept of immigration and not letting people, not embracing people and not letting people come to other shores or asylum seekers, that history keeps on repeating itself. It's happening right now. It's happening in our country. It's happening in other parts of, it's happening here in Europe with Syrian refugees. So I thought I should not just let it take place in 1939, but at the present time, and because it speaks to, this subject matter keeps on coming up.
This is one of the shows, by the way, that's going to be part of the readings, and that's tomorrow night.
That's tomorrow night, yeah, okay. Sotto Voce.
Before I let you go, I did want to ask you, too, because I'd seen there's a premiere coming up in the spring in New York, I believe. It's, I guess, a new show that you've got going on, Exquisita Agonia, Exquisite Agony.
Okay. Yeah, Exquisite Agony. I'm still writing it.
Okay.
It's been announced, but I'm still writing it.
All right. Well, where are you in the process? Are you going to be ready by April?
I hope so. I mean, I'm juggling two or three projects. I'm also writing an opera, and so it's two or three things. It's difficult. And also directing for the company that we have here in Miami.
Yeah. In the last 30 seconds, real quickly, coming back to the time you're going to spend at FAU, really, what's the most important thing that you want to give this group of students and the people who are going to be there?
Well, more than anything, I'm going to talk about my inspiration, and I'm going to, it's more than anything, to give an inspiring talk to the students and talk about the process of writing and share my own process with the students and hopefully give them courage.
We're going to have information about that, by the way, on our website. Again, it's Nilo Cruzes at the Florida Atlantic University Playwrights Forum and Masterclass Series this weekend. He's the 2003 Pulitzer Prize winner for drama for his show Anna in the Tropics. Nilo Cruz, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up still, we're going to talk about a young woman here in South Florida, in Broward, actually, who made history this year. I got that story coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Holly Neher made history this year. She became the first female to start as a quarterback in high school football in the state of Florida. Neher plays at Hollywood Hills High School. Her coach, Brandon Graham, once described her as having the it factor for making it as a quarterback. Now, I recently spoke to her about her success and all the media attention that she received lately, and she talked to me from her high school gym. Why did you want to play on the football team?
Well, at first, after flag football season ended, I wanted to keep on playing. And then I remembered that Coach Graham is also the head coach of the boys tackle team. So I was all like, hey, why not? Why don't I play? So I talked to Coach Graham, and he said that I can be able to play, that I have the ability, I have the right mindset, as long as I stay dedicated and I push myself to play the sport. And I committed to doing that. And my mom and everybody in my family supported me and told me to go for it. So that's why I did it.
You know, Holly, I played high school football a long time ago, before you were born. I remember there were no girls. I mean, no girls ever even talked about it. And I remember that being a very hyper-masculine world. And I'm curious, what was the reaction of your teammates when you showed up?
At first, I thought they were going to have the same mindset. This is a boy sport. What are you doing here? But when I walked in, like, they knew my name before I even walked in. Like, they walked in, they're like, oh, hi, Holly, hi. They're like, oh, we're your brothers. And they were just, like, arms wide open and just, like, invited me into the team. It's like, we're just one big family.
All right. What about when you take on other competition? What have you heard from players from other teams?
Well, this season, one of our games, at the end of the game, I think it was Pompano. Yeah, at the end of Pompano, their team were like, good job, Holly. They knew my name, and they were saying that I'm making history. Like, they have not said anything negative to me. They said anything but they said positive things, and it kind of caught me off guard. I was expecting boys to be like, why are you here? No, no, no. But they didn't. They were like, good job, Holly. You're making history, Holly. I was like, wow, like, that was amazing.
Do you ever worry, though, that, you know, and again, I'm just going back to what it was like when I was there. Maybe times have changed, but, you know, you're talking about young men, and they're still trying to develop as human beings, and, you know, their egos could be a little fragile. And, you know, I remember hearing, you know, guys say, hey, if anything, don't get beat by a girl.
Sometimes I practice when we mess around and I, like, catch a ball over a boy or anything happens. They're like, oh, she's a girl. But mostly just for, like, joking-wise, but it's nothing more or less serious.
What was it like the first time you got tackled?
The first time I got tackled, well, I wasn't paying attention of the guy coming. He hit my blind side, so I didn't even know that he was coming. So when I got tackled, I mean, I didn't even lay on the floor for, like, a second. Like, I got hit, and I was like, oh, well, I just got hit. Like, it didn't hurt. It just caught me off guard. So then the running back was like, oh, man. It's like, they did not think I was going to get up because I got hit really hard. They didn't think I was going to get up. But when I jumped back up, my quarterback coach was like, Holly, are you okay? Do you need to take that? I'm like, no, coach. What's the next play? And, yeah, it just kind of caught me off guard. I felt it the next day. I was sore, but... yeah, it was cool. I mean, I don't want to get hit again, but it's cool. I mean, if I get hit, I get hit. If I don't, I don't.
Do you in practice ever worry that any of the guys may take it a little bit slower because they're worried about hitting you?
I play quarterback, so the quarterbacks are not allowed to get hit. Any of the quarterbacks, we cannot get hit. I practice, so I don't have to really worry about that, because if we get hit, then the other team will get in trouble. It's not just, I mean, the other players on my team will get in trouble. It's not just me, it's other quarterbacks that we can't get hit at practice.
Where did you learn how to play football?
Every time I was little, I mean, I live in a neighborhood with a whole bunch of boys. Everybody plays outside, and I love playing outside, but in order to play with the boys, you got to do what the boys do. So I was like, oh, can I play? They're like, oh, no, you can't play. So they taught me how to throw. They taught me. And I just, like, always just kept throwing and kept throwing because I wanted to get good so they'll let me play with them. So I just end up getting really good at throwing. So every time I go outside, even till this day, I still go outside. And I would play all-time quarterback when we play a little 7-on-7. And, yeah, and I just learned how to throw from doing that and just playing with the boys all the time outside.
Take us back to that first game, because talking about throwing, you know, it was what, the second or third play that you're in, and you toss the ball down the field, a deep pass, and it went for a 40-plus yard touchdown. Take us back to that moment. What was that like?
Well, when coach told me the play, and I was like, okay, Holly, you've done it at practice over 100 times. I trust my receiver to catch the ball, and there's no reason why I can't do it. So I'm like, just take your steps and throw the ball. I mean, there's no reason why I can't. And when I threw the ball, and at the first second, I didn't even notice that because I can't see him, so I didn't even know if he caught it. But when I looked at the sideline, everyone was screaming, go, go, go. I'm like, I think he caught it. And then when he scored, I was just in shock. I'm like, wow, I did it. Like, I just threw a touchdown. And it's my first pass of the game. I threw a touchdown. Like, that's amazing. And I was just more shocked and more, I just felt so accomplished. And then after I felt that, then I started screaming and jumping in the air. Everybody was jumping, even the coaches. They were just, it was just felt like a huge accomplishment. Even though we didn't win the game, it's just that accomplishment felt as if we won.
How do other girls at school see you?
They see me Well, when they come to me, they say that I inspire them and that I'm brave and that they really look up to me and that they would have never, ever thought about doing something that I did.
You know, your story, from what I understand of it, is really amazing because, you know, you had to grow up very quickly. Your mother was battling health issues when you were younger. What was that like growing up and really having to grow up very fast and become a support for her?
I mean, when I was younger, I really, of course, I wanted to have that fun and playful childhood and all that kind of stuff. But when my mom got sick, I really felt the response because I was the older sister. My little sister looked up to me, and my mom couldn't provide. My mom couldn't be that mom right then when she could because she was going. Stage 4 cancer takes a lot. And I felt I had the responsibility. And my dad, he wasn't there. My mom, not like he was there as a dad, but like my parents are separated, so they don't live together. You know what I mean? There's not a dad in the household to actually step up. So I had to go in there and to make sure my sister's okay, take care of my sister when I could, and sometimes clean and cook when my mom couldn't because she was sick on the couch. So I just felt I had to take up the responsibility and maybe sacrifice a little bit just so my mom and my sister could have it better, and I needed my mom to get better. And I think by me sacrificing a little bit, it just made my mom fight this and show that her kids were here and that she had something to fight for. And I think it made me a stronger person just to go through that, maybe grow up a little bit fast. But I mean, I'd rather have grown up fast than lost my mother. And I'm so glad she's here today. I mean, she's my hero. I love her so much.
You already know what you want to do. You want to go to law school. Why?
Ever since I was little, I always felt that, I don't know, I'm very defensive and I always want to fight my battles. I always have something to say. I always want to argue to the point. And ever since I was in high school, my freshman year, I started taking a law studies class. And I just found it was so interesting. And it just, I'm not a big fan of school, I mean, but that class has just got my attention and I wanted more of it. And ever since I was little, I always would watch Judge Judy with my mom and always mess around and be like, I'm going to be a lawyer. But now that I'm actually taking like a little taste of the classes, and I'm just like, I love it. I just want to go in school and college and actually become a lawyer.
Holly, what's it like when you come across any naysayers, you know, or what do you want to say to people who just don't accept that girls can play football with boys?
I know back in the day it was a male-dominated sport, but we are in 2017. Anything is possible. There's no such thing as the impossible. Beat the impossible. You can do anything. It's 2017. We're in the 2000s. You got to have an open mindset, and anybody can do anything what they put their mind to. It doesn't matter age, size, sex, gender. It doesn't matter.
And what does your mom think about the fact that you're playing football, tackle football?
Yes. When I told my mom, she was, all right, Holly, you can do this as long as your grades stay up and you stay dedicated to the sport. I'm like, are you sure, Mom? She's like, yeah, go ahead. I'm like, okay, my mom supported me. Everybody supported me. I just knew I was going in there and that I could do it.
And again, that's Holly Neher. She is a junior at Hollywood Hills High School. Really a great story. If I could just say, because I did tell her back in the day I played a little football, football's a tough sport. I didn't say it's a man's sport. I said it's a tough sport. And you know what? There are a lot of females who are tough enough to play it. So I congratulate her on her success, and I can hope that she continues that success. By the way, a few days after this interview, Hollywood Hills did lose to West Broward, and she didn't get to play as much. But, hey, she still suits up, and she's out there playing with the guys. That's Sundial for Thursday, October 5th. Sundial's produced by Maeve McGoran and Polly Landis. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our technical supervisor, the band behind the buttons, is Jason Zapka. Our theme music, by the way, the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Go to palo.com. And you can check out all the programs, Sundial programs, at WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in to Sundial. Let's do it again next week. Have a great weekend.